some time to recover from the effects of being in the desert with very little water and a bad diet and no chance for proper hygienic measures. I mean, did you get better once you got back into Egypt? Was that the time when you...
Well, I think once you started being able to wash and shave and clean your boots and polish your brasses, and you know, you felt then that a different person. I always still do. If I have a shave in the morning, I feel so much better. And I think it was the same then. You know, you felt so much better to be able to wash yourself and to feel clean after 2 months of, you know, having been soldiers and always used to being clean and smart and that sort of thing. It's foreign the way we were. That's right. So it was, you know, it made all the difference. And I think if you're feeling the right attitude as well, you know, if you've got any ill effects or anything, you soon overcome them and be able to wash your, if you had a desert sore, to be able to bathe it and any other thing you've got, bathe and you're a different person.
Did when you got back into Egypt, presumably it was easy to get water. What about better food? Did you get a...
Oh yes, they what they used to do when you used to get back, they used to make a central cookhouse. So instead of cooking yourself on a number two cooker, there'd be a central cookhouse where squadron cooks would arrive, and then you would have meat cooked and all the potatoes and stuff like that, and you'd go and eat from the central cookhouse, which was so much better. And they could go back and get a good variety anyway. You know, you'd get a pudding after the meal and things like that, and you'd have probably fried eggs and some bacon for breakfast instead of the bully beef fried up as we'd always been used to. So the diet changed.
What about things like fruit and fresh vegetables?
No, you didn't get that. I think you got a few potatoes perhaps, but there was no great issue of fruit, you know, because again, you still had to come a long way, and transporting fruit, I suppose, in backs of lorries that from Cairo would have taken 3 or 4 days anyway, and then it'd have to get to wherever the supply depot was. I think that sort of thing was out. I think the fruit lime was about the only thing we saw. Which,
did you eat them? Or
I think squeezed the juice and drank it with a drop of water. It's not the sort of thing you can really eat, like an orange or. But there was, it sort of did us good. We were enjoying life that way, but it didn't last for long because we got replacement vehicles were coming up, and some people were sent back to Cairo for a leave. Unfortunately, I didn't. And I felt really that if I'd have gone back, I felt that I would have been sort of evading my responsibilities, really. I thought the people who should go back are the soldiers and sort of the younger chaps and that sort of thing. And it didn't worry me particularly, you know, but I couldn't have gone back, really, because I felt my place was there with the squadron. So it's no man's indispensable, though, is there?
They do say that.
Yeah, but if you've got that feeling, that the sense of responsibility, I think, more than anything, I didn't go back. So not everyone went back, mind, you know, so it's not a case of I was the only one who didn't go back, there were others who didn't. And at that time, we were in this camp, you know, and dotted around the camp on the perimeter would be the desert roses. You've heard of the desert rose, have you? Well, we were very strict about hygiene. You know, if you were going to be in the camp for a month, you couldn't just come outside your bivvy and spend a penny, you know, because the place would have stunk with urine. So all around the outside the camp, we used to get a petrol tin, one of these silver tins, cut it in half, punch holes in it, and then that would be mounted on a tubular one made into a tube on top of that, and then you'd use that as a urinal. So and that'd go down into a hole in the ground. So everybody knew if they wanted to spend a penny, they'd go out to one of these nearest to their thing. So it was just a matter of keeping the place clean. That's right. So that was the thing we used to have. And of course, there'd be for a main latrine, there'd be one dug somewhere out away. So that was important to keep the flies away from you, because that would attract the flies. So as I say, that was the desert rose, they were called. And and then we were issued with Tommy guns. They were a new piece of equipment they were issued to us, and we thought these were great. Well, the American gangsters were always noted for their Tommy guns, weren't they? And we had these round drums fitted on, and we had loads of ammunition, so we could go out into the desert and set up targets and sort of do lots of Tommy gun shooting. And we had one of these per armed car issued. And so that was something new, which kept us amused for a while.
What was the idea of that? Because previously, as I remember, you'd always carried a pistol, hadn't you?
Oh, we still had pistols.
You still carried on
the pistol. Oh, you still had your pistol, but that was an addition. I suppose if you were in an armoured car with lots of infantry attacking you, you could use that as opposed to a rifle. Because you couldn't always use your main armament, and it was just something that an addition weapon. And as I say, we had those. I suppose the Americans had sent them up to us.
Had you ever been in amongst enemy infantry?
Not that close, no. I think the only time was that they'd have been useful. It was at Dunkirk, you know, and those sort of areas. But certainly not on the desert, although later it came to that, although later they were surrendering. You weren't sort of really fighting that close.
It was escorting them.
That's right, or they'd come up and surrender.
Well, this being in Italy?
On the desert,
after
El Alamein. You know, there was hundreds of prisoners there, you see. So, I never found any use for them. They're short range anyway, and if you've got that close to an infantry line, I think in an armoured car you're a bit too close.
Well, yes, I mean, if you are too close to use your Bren gun,
that's right,
your main armour, your visa, then it was time to run away, wasn't it?
Well, I think it was, because they'd probably have, I don't know, did they have a PSN, anti-tank? They certainly would have had something that would have knocked us out. They'd had these hand grenades and things like that, wouldn't they?
Well, they did eventually develop a form of bazooka.
That's right, a phosphotone.
Yes.
Yeah. But I don't know whether they had that on the desert. They certainly had it in Italy.
Yes.
They might have had it later, after El Alamein time, I think, probably. But they're certainly not at this stage, I don't think. So anyway, we had those. And
what sort of targets were you shooting at?
A petrol can. Oh. You know, anything like that. You just stick a petrol can out there and
pot at it,
yeah.
What sort of range do you think you could...
Well, I think they had a limited range. I don't think they were much use after about 30, 40 yards, I think. I can't remember offhand, but I don't think
that's
they were...
really much better than the pistol, is it?
No. Yeah. Although with that you've got a spray of bullets, whereas the pistol, you know, it's a single shot, and you have more chance of hitting a target, I think, with a spray of bullets like that. Because, you know, for getting to the gangster type, you know, that one.
It does sound rather more like a gangster weapon.
It was. I don't think, I can't recall anybody using it in anger anyway. I think it's a bit of a gimmick, really. But anyway, we had all the ammunition you wanted to practice with it anyway, if you wanted to. By the end of February, we were back to being fully equipped with new vehicles, or replacement vehicles anyway.
Same as the
Humbers.
No
change in equipment now, just the same. And same trucks, no change in establishment or anything like that.
So it's just a replacement of vehicles.
That's right. Yeah, we had a month. And on the 3rd of March, we were stocked up with water, cigarettes, food, and luxury goods. And during the first day, we covered about 100 miles. And then we got rain for 2 days. But we still kept going anyway. But in the distance, we could see the bombers bombing Tobruk. Because Tobruk held as we came back. So they were bombing that.
So but you had about three months actually in the field. And then you had
a month, that's right. That's right.
We
were back up again. Yeah, we were back by the 3rd, and I think we left the other place on about the 3rd of February, I think. So it was about a month, near enough, anyway. And because I always found it, having been out of action for a month, going back in to the shelling, one a bit apprehensive, very jumpy. When the shells start to fall, until you get into the swing of things again.
How long does that take to get back into the swing after you've been out of it?
Well, it depends how often the shells dropped. If they start dropping every day, then I think 2 or 3 days you're back. Your nerves are not quite so. But the first couple of shells that drop, you jump in the air a bit. But
that's because you've got used to not having.
That's right. You'd sort of forgotten that bit, I think, but then, like anything, if a sudden noise, bang, one automatically jumps. But when you've had it so often, you still jump a little bit, I think, but not quite on the same scale. So it takes a little while to get adjusted to the from the luxury way of life to the dangerous way, I think.
I mean, do you remember if when you were going back, you felt pleased that you were going back?
Oh, yes. Yeah, I think we needed the rest. We were looking forward to not being bombed and shot at. You get that feeling, the further you got back, oh, how lovely, and be able to stop in the sea and have a swim, something like that, which we could do. There was never any grief at coming back for a rest. I think only an idiot would sort of say, well, I'm not going back, I'll stay, if he's in the thick of it, unless there was some special reason to. If it meant that you'd be sort of deserting your friends, I think then it's a different matter. But if it was just a normal way of coming back, then you've done your bit there, and now you go back for rest, and then you're ready to come up again.
Were you, quite content to go back in people after your month out?
Oh, yes. I mean, we knew that, it's our job, and therefore, we're quite happy. We've had a rest, and we're refreshed. We got everything. We got new vehicles and crews all ready, and you go back and do your job.
Ready to go back in.
Hmm.
So you're moving up. Were you moving up across country?
Oh, yes, across country. And that used to be quite a sight to get the whole regiment, sort of in arrowhead formation, and each squadron in arrowhead formation. They take up a tremendous area, all going, and the dust's flying up. If you can get to the front, you're better off. I always used to volunteer to do the navigation. So So I'd be I'll lead, and I'd be sitting on the turret with my sun compass, if the sun was out anyway, and on a bearing, and keep it on that bearing and go for 100 miles. You know, it's great, like being at sea really.
Know where you were going.
Oh yes, you'd have a reference where you were going, and you'd mark it out on the map and get your.
Well, I mean, on this occasion, when you were moving off, did you know where you were?
Oh yes.
Going to be doing?
Oh well, I don't think necessarily we knew what we were going to do, but we knew we'd have to get to a certain area where then we would come under a particular division, or under the Corps, with either be. Under corps command or under divisional command, but we'd make for there, and then we would get our orders once we got to that location.
You mentioned maps. I mean, were the maps good?
No. Well, really, all the map would be is like a coloured piece of paper, really, with a few brown spots on. But there were no. There might be an odd dotted line, which say would be a track. In an area of about 500 square miles, you know, nothing. And occasionally they'd have it marked by a barrel number 501 or barrel so and so, and they were the good guys. But there's nothing really you could pinpoint on, like a factory or a house or anything. You just went on a bearing, and you'd calculate by the miles you'd gone. On that bearing where you were, but there's nothing to confirm it unless you came to a particular place where there'd be a barrel, and there'd be a mound of stones with a barrel on, and it'd be marked barrel whatever, and they'd be dotted, you know, they might be 200 or 300 miles apart, but at least that gave you an aiming place or somewhere where you could confirm where you were. I know there were one or two tracks which were the main tracks. I think F track was one, if I remember once. It's a famous one. And they used to be marked. But we were never on those tracks. We'd be miles to the south of them or whatever, so you couldn't sort of get on it. But
did any of the maps you should have markings on them showing the going?
No, but they had... I think they did, really. But you would have to work that out for yourself, you know, that'd be sort of a brownie patch or a whitish patch, and you'd know, well, that is salt and that's brown. But there'd be places marked, like the airfield, there'd be Masusa Airfield marked, or there'd be Makili marked, but they'd be miles away from things, you see, and you'd come onto it. Those places would be marked, and the odd mosque, if there was one somewhere, very small one, about the size of this room. That's right, that might be on it, you see. But as I say, you could pass it and not see it, you know, on the desert, because it could be miles away. But you'd get a rough idea of where you were anyway. And the most important thing I used to find, if you got the compass bearing and your driver gave you the mileage that you'd done on that bearing from his speedometer, then you know near enough where you are. And when you got to somewhere which was a point which you could confirm it with, then you were made. Further north of that, where we were, up towards the Mediterranean, there were more places you could pick. You know, when you got on the coast road, for instance, they had kilometre stones and that sort of thing, you know, and tracks south and that was much easier, but when you were down south, it was not quite so good.
It's all dead reckoning.
Yeah.
How many days were you moving up then when you did this trip?
I think it was about 4 days.
So that would be a considerable distance, wouldn't it?
Oh, yes, it was quite. I think we got. We took over on the 10th of March.
Do you remember who you took over from?
I think it was the South Africans. I think it was South African Army Car Regiment. I think. I don't know whether I've got it here. I might. And that was in the Gazala, forward of the Gazala line. And of course, the Gazala line ran from the coast at Gazala south to Bir Hakeim, and the Free French held that, and that was the line where the Battle of Knightsbridge took place.
Did you see the Gazala line as you went through it?
Well, you could see nothing much visible of it. I think it wasn't until we came back through it that we saw it. But we went up beyond there, and there was the line of Gazala, Makili, and what's the other name of the place? Tengadar. And that was about, I'd say, 15, 20 mile, I would think, forward of the main line. But behind us were the minefields. We were in a tricky spot, really, because we were forward, and the minefield was behind us. And so, and the Germans were up near Makili.
Ahead of you.
Yeah. So we were sort of more almost boxed in. And we.
Did you have a map showing where the gaps in the mines were?
Yes, but I don't think we had them clearly. You know, but I think we would found that out as we came back. You know. We were hoping not to come back in a hurry, actually. Bir Hakeim to Gazala was about 50 miles.
So you've got one regiment. Was it just your regiment out front?
Yes, I think it was. No,
so
I think
one regiment covering the 50 miles.
That's right, yeah. And the French, Free French were in Bir Hakeim. I think they looked after their own front. And
did you have a liaison with their right?
Yes, yes. We had one or two the Free French around. We met up with them quite often.
What impression did you get of them?
Oh, they were a pretty tough lot. They were the Free French. I think they said they were legionnaires, but they were pretty tough sort of people. And they used to have these one-ton portees, you know, with I don't know if they had 6-pounders then on the back, but they certainly had their equivalent, which was a
anti-tank gun mounted
on a truck. Yeah, and they used to go out at night a lot on patrols.
So this used for their recce purposes, the portees, or did they have armoured cars or anything?
Oh, I didn't see any armoured cars. No, that was their main, because they were infantry legionnaires, and that was their main sort of truck, jack of all trades.
So they're using the one-ton portee as a recce vehicle.
That's right, and the fighting patrols used to go out on them as well.
But I mean, this one-ton thing is a soft skin.
It is, yeah. I don't know how much of that recce they did, though. You know, I don't think they did recce in the same way as we did. I think where we were sort of so far forward, and we covered mainly from the north, really, and they were right down in the south, so they weren't expecting anything apart from a big push south to them, and I think we would more or less cover that.
What was ground like in that area?
A little bit hilly at places, you know, some of them fairly big dunes and flat pieces, and you know, it was quite a different area to what we'd been used to. It wasn't completely flat.
Did that mean that you could rear up with more cars to cover the ground, get the lines of sight?
No, I think we could manage that by being up on high ground. We could see, and where we were, we could see the track that led to Makili, and you could see the enemy transport moving along the track, and you used to keep track of the number of vehicles that had gone into Makili, or so much as leaving Makili, and that's what we were doing, just counting up the number of vehicles going back and forth to get an idea, I suppose, of how the build-up was going.
Were the Germans building up?
They were building up, yeah.
Were they active in trying to counteract your recce activity?
Yes. That's right. We did take over from the South African Army Car Regiment.
Were they able to give you any useful information?
Oh, I think, you know, we took over their positions and they filled us in on what was what.
What were the viewing points?
Yeah, and the best places and where the enemy were and all that. Then, you know, it was a good handover from them.
How long did that take?
Oh, a day. A day. Do that in a day.
Was that done at all levels? Did you have a...
Yeah, each squadron took over its own... Each troop took over his own troop, and he sort of filled in there, while the squadron leader of the armoured car, South African Armour Company, filled in the squadron leader of ours, and so it went on. It was that type of handover.
Did you have dealings with their warrant officer, the squadron warrant officer?
Just to meet them, and sort of the main thing, really, there was nothing for him to tell me. You know, because the main things is the positions of where the troops were, you know, and where the enemy was, that sort of thing. The rest of it, I mean, it was up to me. But we did have, I think it was McKeeley, and the regimental headquarters was at Tyleem Hills, which was at the back of us, which was a range of... how can I describe it? As I envisage the Rocky Mountains, sort of how they would look, but they were sand, and you could go in amongst them and get some good shelter, and that's where our HQ was. And the rest of it was a plain that led to them. You see it in the distance, coming up out of the desert. I don't know whether you could visualise something like that, and that's RHQ, which would be about 10-15 mile away from where we were. And where we were, where C Squadron was, we had a well, and one troop was sort of more or less sitting on the well, you know,
just holding it,
and water was, you know, really good from there. Whole squadron was being supplied with water, which was great. And then once in a while, the Germans would want to refill with water. So they used to send out half dozen tanks, make as though they were attacking us, you know, few shells. Everybody would drop back, you know, think, no, there's a push coming. We'd drop back about 5 miles. The Germans would come up with their lorries, fill up all their water drums and whatnot, go back, the tanks would go back, we would go back to our positions. And that used to happen once a fortnight, 3 weeks, they'd come and refill the water, and then they'd go back again. And there was no booby trap set, nothing like that, they just go back, and that was it. And one troop leader who was sitting on one of these positions, he was sitting reading a book, and he had to leave it pretty quick, so he left his book there. And when he came back, there was a note with some German books, magazines or something, with a note, thank you for the book, and left some books for them. You know, which I thought was rather good, really. That was, I forget what troop leader it was. That's one of C Squadron. I think it's written up in the regimental history.
Did anyone read German? Do you know in the squadron?
I don't know. There might have been one or two of the officers there, but nobody particular.
The Germans must have been able to read English.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Thank you. I think the books they left were magazine sort of thing, you know, like, not Playboy exactly, but that type of book, I think. You know, which, but it was a good gentleman's arrangement there. And every morning, a Messerschmitt, one Monroe would fly over, and that would be the reconnaissance plane. And I think once they came down the machine gun, and that's where Unsworth was killed. So he was in the back of the one went on a track being towed, and they machine gunned, and it set fire to the truck and it killed him.
Very unlucky
him. Mm, yeah. And a bit later there, we were attacked by the air, and we lost a couple of